to be the last in the current series of identifying Jewish status. I think we've covered a fair amount of territory. We could probably spend a full year on any topic, but it's, I think, more interesting to diversify. So we'll complete this particular subject today. And then, Yirtzeh Hashem, go on to another topic when we continue next time. But next time will not be next week, because I'll be at the ACO conference, the conference of the Association of Kashrus Organizations, Yirtzeh Hashem. I'm going to be speaking there. That's going to be in New Jersey, assuming that the world doesn't end by then. But, you know, if it does, then, you know, it's not really, though. So it's irrelevant anyway. And then the following week, Yetz Hashem, we'll continue. And if the world ends, it should end with the coming of Mashiach. We'll go on to the next stage of Yemos Mashiach, so it should all be good. So the topic today is different groups of Jewish populations. We spoke about if a person comes from a normative Jewish community where you don't know if the person's Jewish or not. So if the person claims to be Jewish, do they have nemanos to say that they're Jewish or not? So we spoke about that. What if they come from a community where you knew that once upon a time everybody was Jewish? They were normal Jews, like in Russia, but through the generations there was a certain amount of intermarriage, of ignorance, a lack of understanding of what it means to be Jewish, various incentives and motivations for people to claim to be Jewish, even though they're not Jewish. So then some of the laws of Ne'emanos might be different, and we've spoken about that in past Shiurim. But what if the entire population is suspect? In other words, there are a group of people, we know that they came from people who thought they were Jewish, and grandparents who thought they were Jewish, and great-grandparents who thought they were Jewish, but the entire region is suspect as to whether they had a valid basis for believing that they were Jewish in the first place. And you can throw in to some of these populations also the concern that maybe, in addition to the fact that they may not have been Jewish to begin with, maybe there was a tremendous amount of intermarriage and assimilation, and also there might be a certain amount of questions regarding legitimacy in terms of mamzerus. Let's say there were populations where they didn't know anything, but maybe they had marriages that could be viewed as valid marriages, because it doesn't really take that much to have a valid kiddushin. You just need a Jewish man to give a ring to a Jewish woman in the presence of two kosher witnesses and say, you're hereby betrothed to me, and boom, they're married. But if they didn't do gittin and they didn't know how to perform gittin properly, and then the woman would go and she would marry somebody else, then that could create a mamzera situation. So all of these different concerns are reflected with respect to three different populations that I want to discuss today. So the first population is Anusim. Second are the Ethiopian Jews, sometimes referred to as the Falashas. And the third population, the Indian Jews, of which there are different subcategories of Indian Jews, the Cochini Jews that have a pretty good yichus, that everybody knew that they were there for a long time. They interacted with the other well-known Jewish populations and were generally accepted. But then you have the B'nai Israel. The B'nai Israel are not exactly the same as B'nai Yisrael, because we're all B'nai Yisrael, and it would be a big trouble if like all the B'nai Yisrael were suspect. So the B'nai Israel are a population in India that probably came there in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, and not entirely clear whether they maintained Jewishness. Then you have the B'nai Menashe. B'nai Menashe seem to be a group of Jews that converted at some point in time. And then you have the B'nai Ephraim, that some people think were just sort of invented out of whole cloth about 20 years ago or so, that also claim to be some group from the Seves HaShvatim. So we speak about Indian Jews, the main category of Jews that are subject to the discussions about whether there's a possibility that they don't need Geirus altogether, or the B'nai Israel. That's really the main category. And the secondary category might be the B'nai Menashe. But the other categories are really either clearly not B'cheskas Yehudim or clearly B'cheskas Yehudim. So we're really speaking about those are the main categories of discussion, mostly the B'nai Israel. So in terms of the Anusim, we know that there were Jews who were forcibly converted during the Spanish Inquisition, and many Jews gave up their lives during that period of time, but others pretended to go along with the forced conversion, but secretly they were still living lives as Jews. They're known as the Maranos, the Anusim, and they were written about by many, many of the poskim of that period. One of the reasons why there was a desire to reconfer smicha in Sfat during the 16th century was so that you could have a bezdin that would be qualified to administer malchus, because all the people who had converted felt that they would be chayav karis and they wanted to expiate themselves through receiving malchus. So we know that this was a big deal. And for many, many generations, there were Jews who really lived furtive lives as Jews, but were, you know, in this category of anusim, and they were afraid of being discovered. A number of them moved to South America, and for reasons that remain unclear to myself and to, you know, certain others, despite the fact that the fear of being killed presumably came to an end shortly after the days of the Inquisition were over. Nonetheless, these families were afraid to divulge their true identities or to accept the full-fledged Judaism. In many cases, Ad Hayom Hazeh, and then you have individuals who came from these families that maintained certain practices of certain foods that they wouldn't eat, certain lighting candles before Shabbos, certain observance of holidays on some superficial level, that they would keep certain things, and that some people from these families will show up in front of a bezdin and say, I want to be declared as Jewish, because we've been living secretly all these years and I'm ready to come out. We speak about people coming out of the closet or whatever, so this is like a happy, you know, coming out of the closet to come out of the closet as Jewish, and they want to be declared as Jewish. And then the question is, well, can you accept the traditions that they say, oh, my mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, they all, you know, had these Jewish observances. If you say, hey, come on, if you really wanted to be Jewish, you could have done it like 400 years ago or so. I mean, you know, you didn't really have to wait until now. And there's something suspicious going on, and how do we know that there was no intermarriage during the past 500 years? How good could your records be anyway? Some family do have somewhat good records, but the attitude of a number of Rabbanim is that we can't really assume Jewishness when people have not been an active parts of the Jewish community for so many years, for over 500 years, and therefore a conversion is always necessary. I remember when Rav Shechter was speaking about these inyanim at a Geirus conference that we had, a conference of the various Bati Din Legir several years ago, and he brought up the question of the Anusim. So he said exactly what I've always been, but I figure, who am I to say it? Like, I don't know, but he said, yeah, he doesn't get it either. So he would assume that if the people are only sort of coming out and emerging now, that we don't really have records that we could rely upon. We don't have a Misora, at least he didn't feel he had a Misora, and you would have to do a Geirus for people who are in this category. There was a woman, an activist, a lady, I remember her name, but I guess for the sake of privacy, I don't have to give her name, but she came to me maybe 20 years ago when I was working at the Beis Din of America, and her mission in life was to have like half of the population of Arizona and New Mexico accepted as Jews, because she said that they're all Maranos, they're all Anusim, and we just have to do Kiruv. You have to do Kiruv, so to explain to them exactly how they're really Jewish deep down, because of all their generations, they came from families, some that settled in South America, or settled eventually in southern the southwest part of the United States, that really came from Anusim Marano families, and we should accept them as Jewish. And I wasn't convinced. I didn't think that all these people that were Cheskas Goyim could suddenly be transformed into Jews overnight, and that it was just a question of Kiva. But I remember it was an interesting conversation. But anyway, I'll start off with the last paragraph of a tshuva that is in the unpublished collection of tshuvos. And Jack, I'll take your question in a moment, but let's just get started. So there's in the unpublished collection of tshuvos by Rabbi Schwartz, so he had written about the issue of adopted children and the shtuki issues that we discussed over the last couple of weeks. And then at the very end of that tshuva, he addresses the letter writer, who is Rabbi Union Shlita from California, and he says, "Nogela Shela Shnia, Odos Isha Mi Panama." So he said, "You asked me a question about a woman from Panama. That the question arose that whether this woman is from the Anusim Shel Sfarad, from Spain, nearly the Kiman Shisocheres Esignasa, since this woman remembers her grandmother, her maternal grandmother, I guess, Isha Yirei Hashem, who was a God-fearing woman, Mispalel, she saw her davening, I guess, I don't know, she took out a sitter or something. Begam Mishpachnu Chsekas Ki Yehuda Meshach Meis Me'oshanim in Panama, and apparently, according to the records of the Jewish community in Panama, their family was known as a Jewish family for 200 years. Again, I don't have a Kabbalah, really, even from Rabbi Schwartz, I don't have a Kabbalah as to how one would even do research about this sort of thing. Ein lefakvik v'yahadusam, so he says, for sure, she's Jewish. Kamal kol toshvek yila Yehudis, just like any other Jew. Yotze anusim karkasa v'sheil sechus rashbesh. He calls the Rashbesh the son of the Tashbetz, who is cited in the Piskei Tshuva in Hilchos Geiris. The b'nei anusim k'shibayim laksor b'tshuva, that when you have, in those days, they were writing, you know, shortly after the Spanish Inquisition, when you had the B'nai Anusim who now wanted to come back because the coast was clear, so to speak, ain't speaking Geras. They don't require conversion. Says everybody here, they're keeping Torah Mitzvahs. I don't know how perfectly, I guess they were keeping Torah Mitzvahs. There is a strong, from a Jewish community in Panama. And therefore he says that I don't think that there's any need for a gear at all. So Rabbi Schwartz, I know, was Mako in certain cases when he had done thorough research. I saw a case where there was a question of a woman who said that she came from the Anusim, and she was married to a certain man. They were, I guess, civilly married at the time, and he was definitely Jewish, and he was becoming more observant, and she wanted to convert. And Rabbi Schwartz performed the conversion, but he performed it in a special way that it was along the lines of what the Rashbesh wrote, that it wasn't, strictly speaking, a geirus, it was more what we call a Kabbalas Chaveirus. What's a Kabbalas Chaveirus? The Ramah writes, that's in source 2, that if you have somebody who was not always observant, but they are Jewish in terms of their mother being Jewish, they're halakhically Jewish, but they were worshipping another religion, or they were, you know, acting like they are worshipping another religion, and now they come back to the fold and they want to do tshuva. So then midrabanan, there's this notion, it's based on a passage in Avos de Rabbi Nasan, in Perakhes, there's a notion of going to the mikvah and being mekabel divrei chaveiros. That's the Ramah here in Hilchos Geirim, Siman Reish Samaches, if you're based. He saw Mumash Yasa Tshuva, ain't Sach Lipo. He's Jewish already, so he doesn't, you know, once you're a Jew, you can't be shorn of your birthright. You know, you're a Jew all the way, right? So Rak Midrabanan Yeshlo Litbo, it's the only Midrabanan that the person goes to the mikvah, to the Kabbal, to love Divrei Chaveiros, Bifnei Gimel. It's a Nemuka Yosef Perakacholei, it's two sources, Nemuka Yosef and Omas Rabbi Nasan, that there's some sort of a notion of doing tshuva. So that's what the Ramah speaks about, that the person does tshuva, but it's not in order to become Jewish. So the Rashbesh is saying, you don't have to be Tovel to become Jewish. The Ramah, who this Rashbesh is quoted by the Piskei Tshuva, is going on this line of the Ramah, says, but nonetheless, rabbinically, there is a notion of going to the mikvah just for purposes of doing tshuva. Like I remember when I was a student at YU, so I used to eat in the cafeteria, and I would just sit at the table with whomever was there. You know, you meet, you know, new people. And there were some very interesting, there still are, very interesting people at YU. So there's one fellow, he was, you know, one of these very, you know, wild intellectuals. And he had all kinds of ideas of different things that he was exploring in life. So I'm sitting there with my, I don't know, my meatballs or my broccoli, whatever I was eating. And he was, I remember that it was broccoli plus something else. And he was telling me about how, if you look, like in the Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, there's like a long footnote of a tshuva that is in some of the editions of the Shulchan Aruch, and it was Radbaz or somebody, one of the early Achronim that's quoted over there about the problems that may be involved in lighting a candle to a voodoo. And he found it very intriguing because he saw that there were different studim. Is it a Avodah Zarah? Is it not a Avodah Zarah? But he was wondering, like, this is an interesting thing to do. So he started to light candles to a voodoo and, like, you know, and he was he felt like, you know, maybe this is something interesting. We'll see what happens, what comes of it, and so forth. And then he went to Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was at YU at the time. And he asked Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, he said, okay, you know, I decided that I'm going to light candles to a voodoo. And Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said, no, you really shouldn't light candles to a voodoo. So he said, I stopped doing it because Rav Aaron told me I shouldn't really be doing it. And I said to Rav Aaron, oh, was it really a big problem that I did it? Like, you know, was it like a Avodah Zarah? Is it, you know, something that I have to do tshuva for? So Rav Aaron told me that I should go to the mikvah and I should get like three men to watch and then I should be mekabel and I'm going to keep all mitzvahs properly in the future. So I went to the mikvah and there were three people and there was, yeah. So it was all over dinner one night. So there is such a thing. So that's what the Rama talks about over here, that if you have a Yisrael Mumar, person goes and is worships the Avodah Zarah. When it comes back to the fold, so there's a notion of doing a Tefillah Midrabanan. So Rabbi Schwartz had this person go through a Tefillah Midrabanan, an immersion for the sake of being Mekabel Mitzvos, because they had come from a family which at least on the outside was worshipping Christianity, but he felt that it wasn't really a conversion to Judaism because they, according to his research, there was ample record-keeping that the family really came from Jewish roots. Why was this important in this case? It had a whole special nusach. I came across this because one of the sons was getting married, and I had to look and make sure that we had a record somewhere that the mother was definitely Jewish. So they said the mother had gone through some sort of a conversion process with Rabbi Schwartz, but it wasn't only that the son was getting married. The son was a Kohen. So it's a question, was he a legitimate Kohen or not? So Rabbi Schwartz, because the man that this woman was married to was a Kohen. So Rabbi Schwartz said, it's no problem. She can marry a Kohen because she's really Jewish. And she's really Jewish, so she can marry a Kohen. So that's what, apparently, I guess both grandparents were Jewish. So Rabbi Schwartz came to the conclusion that it was mutter for her to marry the man, and that the children who would be born from this union would not be considered to be would not be considered halalim, because it was a marriage of a Kohen to a woman who was born Jewish, and therefore the children were Kohanim Kesherim. So that was something that only Rabbi Schwartz had the broad shoulders to come to that type of determination. But he felt that in these cases, as we see from this tshuva, this unpublished tshuva that's soon going to be published in Yetzer Hashem, Rabbi Schwartz felt that in certain cases this was appropriate. So if you look in the Piskei Tshuva, he quotes the Rashbash in full, and he says that Bnei Hamumim Harelim Nekvar Manusim, that when you have the children of these people who are Anusim, Keshibayim Lakser B'tshuva Ein Odim Mitzvos Kalas V'Chamus V'Onshan, you don't have to give them the whole rigmarole of the full-fledged conversion process. Vein lebalo, you don't have to frighten them. But yesh lemoshko chesed, you should bring them in with cords of love, vein tzarech tefillah, and they don't really require tefillah altogether. That's how he held it. They don't really require tefillah, at least not for purposes of conversion. And they don't get any special brachos of lamula sagerim. They just, the bracha is al hamila, and you give them a nice brachos of chizuk, and that's the end of it. So the Minchas Yitzchak in source Dalit over here was dealing with a case of a person who was taken, I guess a young girl. She was saved during the Holocaust by being taken in by a family that was a Christian family. And she discovered that in order for her to be saved from the Holocaust, her parents placed her with this family, and she was baptized, and that she went to churches and so forth. But then when she was just, you know, a few years old, afterwards, when she was 5 years old, she was able to be rescued from there, and she grew up through in a family of Torah mitzvos. I don't know if it was her family or a different family, but now she wants to know, her husband wanted to know whether there was any kind of process that she was supposed to go through at this point in time, whether she needed to go through a tefillah. So the Minchas Yitzchak said, well, there is such a notion that the Rama brings, but then he quotes the Radbaz, that says that this only applies to people who converted willingly, or if they were from a family that had converted, but they had an opportunity to come back to the fold, and they put it off for a very long time, so then the tefillah would be appropriate. But if they only stayed in the fold of, let's say, Christianity for as long as they didn't know any better, or when they were being forced to do it in order to save their lives, but the first opportunity they had to come back to Judaism, they came back to Judaism, so then it wouldn't be necessary for them to go through tefillah. And then he quotes a story from the Avos de Rabbi Nassan. The Avos de Rabbi Nassan indicates that even when a person wasn't at fault, it talks about a Riva Acha Shinishbeis, a young lady who was taken captive, and the young lady could have been underage, could have been, you know...
Are you saying once you're baptized, you're not Jewish?
No, you're still Jewish. You're still Jewish. The question was that she was brought up like going to church and stuff like that for the first few years of her life. She was Jewish, but the question was that she have to go through this tefillah, this immersion that the Ramah talks about, that even a Jewish person goes through if they practice Christianity, not to become Jewish. The person was always Jewish, but just it's like a tefillah for purposes of being metahir themselves, or for doing tshuva. So if you understand it as tshuva, so if the person didn't do anything wrong, they were just forced, that they were a very young child, they shouldn't have to do tshuva. But then he quotes the Yavas to Rabbi Nassim that talks about a young lady who was taken captive, and even though nothing happened to her, when she was captive, she didn't willingly convert to Christianity or anything, or to whatever idolatry it was of her captors, but the captors forced her to eat their food and to drink their drinks and to do whatever the things were that they were doing. So therefore, there was a requirement afterwards, says the Mishnah there in the Avos to Rabbi Nassim, that she had to undergo a tefillah just to come out of that state of tumah. So it sounds from here that if a person was in a state of just tumah, that they were, you know, worshipping a avodah zarah, even if they weren't responsible per se, then they would still have to go through some sort of a process. So he says maybe it was different, maybe that Reva was already gedoyla, and therefore there was a greater state of either accountability of tuma, but this girl that we were talking about was only brought to church until she was 5 years old. But then he says, no, but even if you're a very, very young infant, you can be affected by your surroundings. So if the tefillah is for purposes of being metayer you from tuma, so if she was exposed to tuma, so maybe the tefillah really should be necessary or appropriate. So then he says at the very end nonetheless, kvar tavla nidasa kamet pa'amim. This is a woman who she was married, so she already went to the mikveh many times because she needed to be tovelis because she was a nida, and therefore that should also count for these purposes. So he concludes by saying, mikol malka miyos tov, just to be on the safe side, b'shas tefilas mitzvah titfal obi miyuka b'shvil zeh. The next time that she goes to the mikveh, she should have in mind, he didn't say she has to gather three men around. He didn't say that. But she should just have in mind that this tefillah will count also for purposes of purifying her from any exposure to Christianity at a young age. But time in Bekabanen, she should say, Hareini mukhanu mizuman, Hareini tovelas la'asim menu azuma, I'm being tovelas in order to remove this stain of contamination. L'hamshich hanafshi ruchi v'nishmasi kedusha v'tara kachol b'nos yisrael k'sheros, and to continue my life with a pure spirit and a pure soul, like all of the kosher Jewish women. Titing am tztaka bekavana, doesn't hurt to give tztaka, and he felt that this is a good solution. This is a good solution. So this source of the tefillah as just being basically for purposes of removing tumah is quoted by the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon quotes this on the Ramah. He says, yeah, it's based on the story in Avos to Rabbi Nassim. So Rav Sendorovic from Milwaukee was dealing with a case of a man who was brought up by a mother who had been Jewish and who married a Christian man and who converted to Christianity and raised the whole family to be Christians. And now the man, at a certain point in time, he found out when he became much older what happened. And he said, this is crazy. I'm not a Christian. I'm Jewish. My mother is Jewish. So he wanted to go back to Judaism, and he wanted to be accepted as a Jew. And the question was, do we require him to go through a Kabbalah Staveris Bifnei Gimel? Do we require him to show up to the mikvah in order to have this procedure, this special ceremony, where he's going to be metayer himself from his tumah? So he said, well, if you look at the Ramah, the Ramah says that the whole idea is that he's supposed to do tshuva. If you look at the Vilna Gaon, the idea is that he's mitire himself, that he's purifying himself from all of the things that he did wrong. So he said the problem with this particular fellow was he wasn't purifying himself from all the things he did wrong. Like in the story of the Reva, she was eating tafus. They gave her non-kosher food and she ate the non-kosher food, you know, that they were feeding her. But in this particular case, this man was eating non-kosher food. He's still going to be eating non-kosher food. He wasn't prepared to be Shoma Shabbos. He wasn't prepared to be from. So what would be the purpose? He said maybe the purpose would be like the Ramah says that he's doing tshuva. So he's not doing tshuva for, you know, all of his sins, but maybe you could say that he's doing tshuva at the very least in the sense that he wants to be mishtayach l'klal Yisrael, that he's returning from Christianity to now belong to the Jewish people. But he says, but the Ramah... I'm sorry? Now, let's assume he's taking care of the bris milah, or he took care of the bris milah. But does he have to? That's a good question. But does he have to? Of course, he needs the bris milah. But the question is, does he need this special tefillah in the mikvah? So the so he quotes the Ramo, says you need kabbalas chaveres b'fnei gimel. You need this official acceptance of all mitzvos in front of three people, but he's not prepared to be mekabel all mitzvos. So then his conclusion is, he says that this tefillah, if we assume that we're dealing with somebody who clearly is Jewish from their maternal line, and so we shouldn't overuse it. And in fact, even the Rama says, the Ein Sorok Lipo, Mak Midra Bodin Yeshul Lipo. This was not in the Bar Ilan Sidur, so I typed it myself, so a couple of typos here. So he said, Rak Midra Bonin, it's only on a rabbinic level that he has to be Toivo. So it's Mashra that it's not really a Chiyuv, so he said, you have to assess every single case. Every single case you have to assess by itself. And he said that, Imkein Liom Yeshlishko Bechomotza Vedera Chanochon. Sometimes having the person go through tefillah is going to be a tremendous reinforcement. Like maybe that fellow I had dinner with in the YU cafeteria, like he gave him chizik to go through tefillah, he would, you know, as a result, he would know he did something which was very bad, and then he'll never ever do it again. But sometimes the person going through tefillah, it's going to be very traumatizing for them to require it, and it's going to be an impediment to them doing a full tshuva. The next source is source Zion. That's Nusach Tudas Yadus Mimoetzet Arabonim to Chicago. Woo, what's that? So here is a Nusach of a Tudas Yadus that we issued. We issued a Tudas Yadus in a case where somebody came in front of us in this basic situation. They want to make Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. They were brought up as a Christian. They discovered their mother was really Jewish. We did the research. The mother, in fact, was really Jewish. But the person was far, far, far away from observance. So it didn't feel a comfort level. The person wanted a tudas yadus, a gushpanka, you know, that they should be accepted as a Jew, viewed as a Jew. We felt you want to be viewed as a Jew for purposes of, you know, our vouching for you when you were brought up as a Christian. So it would be better for you to go through this proper procedure, since this person had gone to churches, had worshipped Christianity for so many years, that we felt it was appropriate for them to be mekabel divrei chaver. It's not for purposes of being Jewish, but because in order for them to just have full-fledged kosher status, shall we say, this was an appropriate thing for them to do, but they couldn't do it yet because the person wasn't prepared to be Shomer Shabbos yet. So we came up with this nusach. Because we felt that we wanted to be mechazik this person to understand that he still had more to do. The mother had converted to Christianity fnei habe shanim v'dasa noitzi v'chenin davoneinu arabim imo gidlo oiso v'shar yilodeh v'dasa noitzi k'shein uchein k'shu yaksu b'tshuva shlema v'zrat Hashem yisparach all of v'hapim mikvah k'sheir l'fnei gimel. So he said that when he completes his tshuva process, that he's prepared to accept all of the Torah, so then he should go to the mikvah in front of three dayanim, in front of three, you know, kosher individuals. Could they the kabbal divrei chaveres, like the Rama says, and we quoted the passage of Avos to Rabbi Nosson, and then we will accept him with great happiness when he returns to the fold of Judaism. So we felt that this was an appropriate line, that an appropriate nusach for the person who came from these circumstances, who came to us.
Just curious, how did that person react to this being a nusach rather than some more like, you know,
it's funny because Rabbi Sendorovic said you have to make a case-by-case assessment. I'm not sure if I had even seen that tshuva of Sendorovic at the time that we made this assessment. It's kind of very interesting. But we really made an assessment that in this particular case, it was appropriate. We felt it was appropriate, and there were no complaints. There were no complaints at all. Now, Rav Mordechai Elio has a special nusach for the Anusim when they come back to the fold. So he has a special nusach which it doesn't quite describe their process as geirus. Normally, when you have a geirus certificate for somebody who underwent the geirus process, so you say that the person was niskayer. You use a formulation. The person, you know, went to the mikvah l'shem geirus. You use the words niskayer l'shem geirus. Harehu ger tzedek. Harehi giyaris tzedek. that is part of the standard standard certificate that you would give to the ger or geiris after the process is completed. So Rav Mordechai Eliyahu felt, if you are dealing with somebody who clearly came from a family and from a tradition of a nusim throughout the generations, and now they're going to come back fully to the fold, you should show that you are sensitive to the reality of their history, and that you have an appreciation for what their family went through, and therefore don't use terminology like ger, geiris, nisgai, or use other terminology. So he says, came up with a special form that this person appeared in front of us, had anusim, we determined the person came from the anusim, and they wanted to return the chek am yisrael, v'lakasos takas kan v'yashchina, we checked the person out, and we saw that they're serious, and so forth. Most of Tlosa, the person was mekabel toru mitzvos, they had a bris milah, if it was a male, or a tafis dam bris, and they were tovil, not l'shem gavis, but what? Tavel or tavla mitumas akum b'mikvah k'sheira, that they were tovel in order to eradicate the tumah, like the story of the Reba and the Avos Rabbi Nosson, to eradicate the tumah that they had ingested by being part of a Christian identity, and they were mekabel o Torah mitzvoseh, and then we said the special bracha of the Rashbe, shatzlach v'nada kodesh bracha, which caused this person to be successful and so forth, and that's the nusach that you should give. At the very end of this document, which I came across, I have a copy of the original of this document. There's an original, so the original endorsements on the bottom of this document by Rav Aaron Soloveitchik and by Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik wrote, "Karasi Yasanav and Nisomek as Yadia Nusach Azeh." It's a great Nusach. You're going to convert a Nusim, use this Nusach rather than a standard Geiris Nusach. And he even gives you the date of when he signed the Tavshin Nuntes, which is probably shortly before he was Nifta, right? Gamini Ma'asher says, Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Gamani Ma'ashir Sanusach Anal, the Yesh Lismach Alav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, based other Tufshin Nun Tes. But what Rabbi Schwartz meant by that is, this is not only a good Nusach to make them feel good, but it's true. Meaning that in certain cases, if you're able to validate that they had a tradition of being Jewish amongst their community for hundreds of years, and that they kept Jewish practices, you really will view the people as fundamentally Jewish, even though you have them go through this procedure. There is a Rav who's working on a Sefer of Hilchos Geiris, a very comprehensive Sefer of Hilchos Geiris, that I was given on condition that I not share it with anybody, but I assume I can share something that was in it. I'm not mentioning the name of the Sefer, the author, or anything. So it's a very, really long Sefer. There's a lot of really good stuff in the Sefer. And he talks about this at one point in the Sefer. Again, it's a draft. I don't know what it'll be in the final version, but in the version that I saw, so he mentions this idea of the Nusach of Mordechai Eliyahu, and he says, of course, the purpose of this nusach is just to make these people feel good. But obviously they need a geiris. These people have, for hundreds of years, we can't possibly verify that, there wasn't, intermarriage, or that the mother's, the matrilineal line was 100% perfect and so forth. Obviously they're going to have to go through a geiris, and obviously we're going to view it as a geiris, but this nusach is just, that they should feel validated in terms of where they're coming from and what their family went through. So there are different ways of understanding exactly the import of this nusach. I can't tell you what the kavanah of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was, when he signed it, and he said, I really approve of this nusach. But clearly, there were Rabbanim Chashuvim who felt that it wasn't just a feel-good nusach, but it was along the lines of what the Rashbeish wrote, because the Rashbeish wrote very clearly that it wasn't a real bona fide conversion. It was really just along the lines of what the Ramah wrote, that it's a Kabbalah's Divrei Chaveris. Okay. Now, we'll go on to the next topic, or the next part of today's topic, which are the Ethiopian Jews, the Palashas. Yes?
The document is important. To what extent
does
the document matter
if the document is proof that the person is Jewish. Once the person has gone through this procedure, regardless of how you view them, whether you view them as that they were always Jewish or that they needed a conversion, so now they're definitely Jewish, right? If you say that they were Jewish all along, so this document at least verifies that there was a Bezdin that made the determination that they were Jewish all along. If I didn't have this document, so anybody can come along and say, I'm from the Anusim. You're not going to just, you know, accept them as Jewish. Certainly if I don't accept somebody who walks in the door and says, I'm Jewish, that they're not from the Anusim, they're from Russia or whatever, Kavachomer, I'm not going to accept somebody who comes from Costa Rica or Panama or Mexico and shows up at my door one day, you know, and says, oh, guess what, I'm Jewish. So what the document does is that it says that a Bezdin reviewed and assessed the situation and determined that the person was Jewish, you know, and if you don't think that's good enough, they went through a conversion process as well, so either way, the person is definitely Jewish now. Nafkamina, whether they can marry a Kohen in terms of, you know, whether they were always Jewish all along, you know, or not. But certainly now, whatever else, they're definitely Jewish at this point in time.
Do you know what Chacham Levi Mortera did in Amsterdam for the Portuguese Jews in the 16th century?
Yeah.
Do you know what? He must have done something, right? Because he converted all those Portuguese Jews to become.
They talk about the Anuse Portugal. There are different subsets, 100%. There are different subsets of Anusim that went through different experiences. This is really more of a question of how do we relate to the Anusim today. Okay?
Right. Now, do you use any of these formulas in order to convert?
I don't know. I haven't seen. I didn't see him quoted. I didn't see him quoted in these, in the classical sources. I just didn't see it.
Okay.
Now, the Ramah talks about other gzeros, that with respect to certain populations, the feeling who did not keep like Torah properly, like the Karoyim, who only kept Torah Shebaktav, not Torah Shebal Peh, their Gittin were not good Gittin, so we said that they're all considered to be Safek Mamzerim, and we won't even accept them at the end of the day. Why? Because we assume that chances are that they really are Jewish, but they're Mamzerim. So we can't intermarry with them anyway, so he says, so stay away from the Karoyim. The Vilna Gaon at the end of Siman Daled and Ebene Ezer says that the same is true with respect he says that this is based on the Gezerah that's found in the Gemara and Kiddushin and Daf Ayin Hay, Rabbi Eliezer, who says that the Kutim are not allowed to, or not accepted, and they're not even allowed to marry each other, because maybe one of them is legitimate and the other one is not legitimate. So the Gemara says that the same sort of imposition is imposed upon the Karoyim. But at the same time, the Ramah says, "Aval hanusim akosim ledasi so nearly shemutu liskatim em kamo b'shar gerim." But the Anusim are going to be we're going to be more lenient about us. We saw we'll accept the Anusim if they're going to come back, just like we'll accept any other person who wants to convert to Judaism. We'll accept the Anusim. Why is it that the Anusim are treated more leniently than, let's say, the Karaim? So the Aruch HaShulchan in the end of Siman Daled and Ebene Ezer says that the difference is that when it came to the Karaim, the Karaim were not, you know, careful about keeping mitzvos and so forth, and marrying people who were permitted to them to marry, and having gittin when it was appropriate, and making sure that an ashes, and they were not careful about making sure that an ashes shouldn't remarry. But the anusim, they were always so careful to keep mitzvos privately, so part of that scrupulous observance included b'chazaka sheshamu tamid kashrus yichusim, that they were very careful about their yichus. Amnam, but he says, nonetheless, gam said totally with the ayin man ha'gosam, you have to check every single situation. You know, you can't necessarily assume what was true in the 16th century is necessarily going to be true in the 21st century. A lot of things could have happened in the past 500 years. So this is sort of the segue into the whole discussion regarding the Falashim. So with respect to the Ethiopian Jews, how do we know that they're Jewish altogether? How do we know that the Ethiopian Jews are Jewish? Maybe they're not Jewish. Some people said that there was like a group of Catholics or whatever they were, or I don't know, I think that they were persecuted Christians or something, that they said, decided at a certain point in time that they're going to claim that they're Jewish in order to give, because they had a lot of civil wars and this would give them like greater legitimacy if they would say that they came from like the first temple period, they came from Sheva Dan, and the whole thing was sort of made up. And there was no proper gerus, there was no proper conversion, and the whole thing is not real. And there was somebody who was a traveler in the early, I guess, during the years of the Gaonim. This is probably even before the 10th century, there was a traveler, famous traveler by the name of Eldad Adani. Eldad Adani went around and he said, oh, I checked out this place, Ethiopia, and there are Jews there, and they're from, you know, Sheva Dan, whatever. I think he basically said they're from Sheva Dan. But Eldad Adani was a controversial figure. Some people accepted him. There were some early, you know, authorities who considered him to be legitimate, and there were some other early authorities like the Ibn Ezra, I think, and the Rami Rutenberg, who were not so crazy about Eldad Adani. So Eldad Adani was a little bit of a controversial character. When you find the contemporary poskim talking about the Jewish legitimacy yichus of the Ethiopian Jews, they're not quoting Eldad Adani. I'm just telling you, they're not quoting Eldad Adani, so they know better than quote Eldad Adani. But they're quoting the Radbaz. The one who wrote the main shuvah on the subject was the Radbaz, Rav David ben Zimmer, who was, of course, a major, major poskim, contemporary of the Beis Yosef, lived for many years in Egypt, with little in Sfat also. So the Radbaz says that there's no question at all that these are people who were Mizeri Yisrael Meshev Adon Harei Shoklim Bahari Kush, and he deals in two different shuvos with situations of a person who was from this community of Ethiopian Jews. One is the case of a woman, one is the case of a man. The woman is a complicated situation. It's like an Aguna situation where the woman's husband was missing. There was a big war. She assumed that the husband had been killed. In the meantime, the person, she was like a shifka, and the master married her and had a son. Now the son wants to get married. So the question is the son a mamzer? Because maybe this woman's first husband wasn't really dead. She thought that he was dead because she said everybody got killed, but the halakha is a woman is believed to say that her husband got killed if it's a time of peace. But if it's a time of war and she thinks her husband got killed, maybe she's just imagining that her husband got killed because she assumes everybody got killed because it was a time of war. So he goes into that. That's the first part of the tshuva. But in the course of the tshuva, he explains one thing is for sure, and that is that this woman who came from Ethiopia and the Ethiopian Jewish community, she's definitely Jewish because they come from Shev Adan. And he talks about that there were three different kingdoms in the Kush. There was the kingdom of Yishmaelim, and then there were the Arameans who kept their own religion, and then there were the Jews from Shev Adan. And he says that Kufiya Nira, he believes that they came from Tzaduk Ubaisus, meaning that they came from the group of the sect of Jews who rejected Torah Shebaal Peh. So in a way, they were similar to the Karaim, but not necessarily going to be treated identical to the Karaim. Why wouldn't they be treated identically to the Karaim? Because the Karaim knew better. And nonetheless, they willfully rejected Torah Shebaal Peh despite the fact that they knew better. But these Jews, they're sitting in Kush, they're sitting in Ethiopia. They don't have any mentors, they don't have any teachers, they don't have any rabbis, they don't have any schools, so they don't know any better. So therefore, they're not going to be treated as severely as the Karaim. So that's going to be a good thing and a bad thing. It's going to be a good thing in the sense that we're not going to make any blanket Isurim to say that we're absolutely going to reject them for all eternity, Isurim, Isur Olam, that we're going to reject them for eternity from the Jewish people. But it's also a little bit of a bad thing because if they're not culpable, so that means that maybe they're really Edom Kshayim. Maybe that means that they're really good Edom. So that's a little bit of the tension that the Radbaz deals with. He says, let's leave aside the question with respect to whether her first husband was still alive. If her first husband was alive, when she married the second husband, obviously we have tzaras. But let's say that we can determine that the first husband was dead at the time that she became pregnant with, you know, this boy who now wants to get married. But he says there's still kind of the question mark with respect to whether we can view these people as legitimate. Because after all, he says that maybe while they didn't have good gittin, maybe they had good kiddushin. So he says, no, it can't be. Because the Kiddushim, who were the witnesses for the Kiddushim? The witnesses were basically the members of the community. Since they came from Tzaduk Ubaisus, and they rejected Torah Shebaal Peh, so therefore, obviously they were all Edom Psulim. But he says, I would still be worried about maybe the very first generation, when they went bad, in that very first generation, they came to Kush. So maybe when they got married, they had gotten married by Edom Ksherim. Then they accepted upon themselves Tzaduk Ubaisus, so they decided that they didn't have to be so strict with respect to the procedures for Gittin. And then the get wasn't so good in the first generation. And maybe from that first generation, you have these descendants. Now, obviously, in the first generation, there would have been some people who only got married after they rejected everything, and at that point in time, there were Edom Psulim, and maybe there was some Edom Kesherim. So he says, no, because he had many, many doubts. Because number one, maybe those people who ended up following Tzaddik Ubaisos, who would have been, you know, real Rishayim, and would have maybe, you know, and not had a proper get, even at the very beginning, Lo Yunisuim Nashim, maybe they were people who weren't married. Meaning that the people who went after Tzaddik Ubaisos, they weren't married when they came down to Kush. They only got married, say, afterwards, after everybody, you know, became puzzled to be Edom. And even if they did get married, maybe they never got divorced. And therefore they wouldn't have had a situation where there was a divorce without a get. And even if they did get divorced, maybe since they got married when they were kosher, so maybe they got divorced when they were kosher, and you know, they had a proper get. And if you're going to say they didn't have a proper get because the Eidim were psulim, even though they had a proper kiddushin, so maybe those particular women who got divorced never got remarried. And if they did get remarried, maybe they didn't have children. And if they never did have children, maybe the children were incapable of having their own children because they were saris or islandess. And even if the children were capable of having their own children, maybe the children died when they were still young. And even if the children, you know, didn't die when they were still young, so maybe this individual person that you find from Ethiopia doesn't happen to come from that particular line. So therefore he says that, I think there was a 9 different spekos, and since you have like 9 different spekos to be told upon, says you could be makel on this basis. I'm sorry? We'll get to Chacham Avadya in a second. Chacham Avadya does base himself very much on this ruling. Right. So the next of tshuva of the Radbaz, Mechelek Zayin Simen Hei, has nothing to do with the legitimacy of the children to remarry and so forth. It has to do with somebody who acquired an Eved who was from the Ethiopian community and wanted to know whether the person is subject to all the dinim of Eved Ivri. And the Radbaz says, there's no such thing as an Eved Ivri if the Bezdin didn't sell him, or if he didn't sell himself in order to pay off his debts, as you just happened to go to the market to buy an Eved, who happened to be forcibly put up for sale. So you know what that's called? That's called the situation of Pidyon Shvuyim, that we have to redeem this person. That's not an Eved Ivri situation. And this person, he said, the person is definitely Jewish because he's from the Ethiopian community. And he says, there's no suffix whatsoever, he says, that these people, he says, Elo Abay Me'eres Kush, is the second paragraph, Hey, me Shevet Dan, believe suffix. There's no suffix that they are from Shevet Dan. The Radbaz was 100% sure of this. And he says that he has a question. Is there a mitzvah of Pidyon Shvuyim? Because maybe, since they don't observe Torah Shebaal Peh, so there's no mitzvah of Pidyon Shvuyim, because it'd be Moridin Velo Malin. We should, you know, get rid of them. So he says, no, because they're like a Tinok Shenishpa, they don't know any better. And in this particular tshuva, he suggests that they're not really from Tzaddik Ubaisos. That Tzaddik Ubaisos were the second base of Mikdash period, and in this tshuva he says that the Ethiopian refugees were left Israel during the Golos Sancheriv in the first base of Mikdash period. So therefore, they're much bigger tzaddikim. So you have a problem. So here the Radbaz says, therefore, ani choshe shem kiddushen kiddushin. Maybe the kiddushin are good kiddushin because the Edom are not puzzle. But nonetheless, the gittin made him ketikun chazal, but the gittin are no good. So in this particular tshuva, he seems to indicate that you might have a problem of the yikos of the Ethiopians. So Rabbi Vanya Yosef, when he dealt with the question of the Ethiopians, he was so proud. You know, you have the right to be proud. You accomplish good in this world. So you see from Rabbi Vanya, you have the right to be proud. He was so proud because he felt he was the one who really pushed, the chief rabbi, pushed all the authorities in Eretz Yisrael to pay attention to the plight of the Ethiopian Jews. And he wrote the Shuvin Tafshin Lamed Gimel about how the Ethiopians are, this community are definitely Jewish. And then he went further to say that he thinks that they're legitimate based on all the spekos that the Radbaz had raised. And he says that therefore there's a tremendous mitzvah. We have to save them. We have to bring them to this country. And then he writes in this tshuva, if you'll go through it, he writes about how he was really responsible for setting policy in Israel that they should go and they should rescue the Ethiopians. And he felt a tremendous surge of pride about it. So Ravadia says something that some of the other contemporary postkin weren't so happy about. He said, I'm going to, you know, pull kind of like a double stunt. Number one, I'm going to tell you that the Ethiopians, Jews, are 100% Jewish, because after all, we have the Aedus of the Radbaz. Not only the Aedus of the Radbaz, but his own Talmud, the Maharikash, who is certainly a very eminent posek in his own right, also went along with the Rabbaz's findings, and he said there's no way in the world that these two eminent authorities would have come to the conclusion that the Ethiopians are, the Falashas are definitely 100% Jewish if they hadn't done their research. We're not irresponsible about these types of determinations. Obviously, they did their research. How could you possibly cast any aspersions or questions at this point in time? And he quotes other authorities throughout the centuries who also followed in their footsteps, including Rav Israel Hildesheimer, who was also convinced that the Ethiopian Jews were, that the Falashim were 100% legitimate, 100% Jewish, and he quotes various chief rabbis over the years who also went along with this determination. So he says that there is ein kol safek that she'agonim anav shekavol l'sheim shevedan chak v'vidarshu v'gil l'maskana zu apiyus urayas mehemnas v'yosef. We don't have the information anymore. He says, if you ask your average anthropologist to go and to do the research, so maybe they're not going to be so convinced based on the data that they have nowadays that these Ethiopians were really from Sheva Dan and that they really came from the Jewish people originally. But he says that we're not dependent upon the anthropologists. We're dependent upon Chachmei Yisrael. He says if we have a sort of a disagreement between the Chachmei Yisrael and the anthropologists, minit lechem in pnei mi. Who wins? Who wins? He says. So some would say the anthropologists win. So he says no. He says the Chachmei and the Chachamim win. The Ravaz wins. The Ravaz says to the Jewish, that's the end of the story as far as I'm concerned. And then something very interesting happens here. Very interesting. And you wouldn't necessarily notice it because it's very nuanced and you wouldn't pick it up. This is a tshuva that was written in Tavshin Memhei. And he quotes from Yitzchak Isaac Alevi Herzog, who wrote in the 1950s in Tavshin Yudalin, that he was a little bit worried. He said he saw that the anthropologists thought that maybe the Falashim were not originally Jews, but they were a people that converted at one point in time for whatever political reasons they may have decided to do so. And they created their own sense of Judaism. They obviously didn't have a kosher bezdin, and they obviously didn't accept all 613 mitzvos. And therefore, it was not a proper geirus. And therefore, yesh the geirim bezdin kosher. Therefore, yesh the geirim bezdin kosher. So what does he say? He says, noros neflesi. I can't believe. He said, I can't believe that he would do such a thing. That he would cast questions, or that the Herzog would cast questions on the legitimacy of the Ethiopians when we had the Radbaz and we had the Marikash, etc., etc. But nonetheless, he says, Loratziti lachlok l'maise ala gon of Herzog. I didn't want to go actively against him. And therefore, I went along with this notion that they should go through some sort of a conversion process. However, what's the conclusion? How does he end? He ends up by saying, "Ulam ledina lo kena noki imadi." He says, but I do not really agree with him at the end of the day. Vidati, and according to my own opinion, sheyesh lismok ala poskim anal, that we can rely fully upon the poskim that I just quoted, shef falashim yehudim l'chol davar, that the falashim are 100% Jewish in every single way, and therefore what? Ve'enem srikim gior afilu l'chumra. And they don't require a gior, even the chumra. Who's the most loyal person in the world when it comes to quoting the psalm of Avadi Yosef? His son, Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef, Karat Rishon Letzion, Eretz Yisrael. And I have no reason to doubt that whatsoever. But whatever he says, as far as I'm concerned, is gold. Whatever he represents from his father. But he quotes the father's original Tshuva in Tavshin Lama Gimel, in which Rabbi Avadia quotes from himself when he was saying to the government of Israel how you need to save and rescue the Ethiopians because they're Jewish, they're legitimate, and so forth. And this Tshuva that he published in Chel Ches of Eben Ezra, I looked at the date, and it's Tavshin Memhei. So if he wrote another tshuva after Tavshin Lamed Gimel that said something different from what is in this tshuva, it would have presumably have to have been after Tavshin Memhei, right? So Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef starts off by quoting his father from the tshuva that he wrote in Tavshin Lamed Gimel, and then he goes on to say, he says, oh, but you should know, he wrote another tshuva in Tavshin Mem Dalet. I don't know where this tshuva is, but he says he wrote another tshuva in Tavshin Mem Dalet, and he's quoting from that tshuva. And he talks about how they're definitely Jewish, and they're definitely legitimate, and so forth. But he says that there were those who, cast questions upon that. Because he said that, after all, you had Rav Yitzchak Isaac Alevi Herzog, Sibu Lassus Leplashim, the Kedin Gil, the Chumab Lebracha, Gamani Nakti Kein Acharem. Therefore, I did the same thing. Kedin Asak or Savik, we had do some Shal Palashim, Kishem, Tkufa Koshin, Kibu Gamer Adosam, because maybe there really were, it was a period that they accepted more, Gayrim who were not legitimate in their community. Mechusi Yadim Elkos Gayrim, so Skyra Gadas, and they wouldn't convert properly. And he said, I'm going, man, and they got mixed up with the others. When Mikol Shekein, he says that in the Shaila Sechuvos, Sitz Eliezer, Mefaklikim, he's Mefaklik Me'odai B'Yadusam, that he has, you know, serious doubts, and he quotes the Sitz Eliezer here in this Tshuva, that we have, if you look in the bottom of page 5, he quotes the Sitz Eliezer, and about 5 lines down, he says, Ulefini Yastaitim Mechilas Kvot Tarasu Ein Rav Nechonim, and he disagrees with Sitz Eliezer. In this letter from Tufshin Mem Dalet, apparently he was willing to say, hey, you know, we gotta be careful, after all, Sitz Eliezer doesn't agree, and he says like this, Bechalila Levatil Atakana Shogir Lechumra. And we should chalila that we shouldn't do this giyur l'chumah. Of course, you got to do this giyur l'chumah. The altasik bul olam asher gavlu mishonim shayid ken yichalek on the machanos. We're going to split Am Yisrael into different camps. Linyan Yisulim and Palashim. Some will say that they're good. Some will say they're not good. So you got to convert all of them. No question. You got to do a giyur. And then he quotes that the Radbaz, you know, wrote in one shuva that you have to worry about their legitimacy. But you know, he said, that's where we find that Dibbe Torah Niyam B'mkom Rashim Mokom Acher. In one place, when he was only talking about whether you treat the Ethiopian like an Eved, so there he, you know, said maybe you have to worry about the Yichus. But in the other tshuva, when he was dealing with the heter of, you know, whether they could be Mutal of Obekal, so there he gives you the heter, the 9 Sfekos that you could be Mekel about. But this is so interesting, because here in this tshuva that is supposedly from, I'm not supposedly, he's quoting, I trust him, from Tufshin Mem Dalet, he says, Chalila Levatila Tekana Shal Giyur L'Chumah. Scorning his father says, of course you gotta do the Giyur L'Chumah. After all, Herzog said so, Sitz Eliezer said so, but here he quotes all of those shitas, and he says, V'dayati that Ledina Lo Ken Anochi Mati. I don't agree with them. I don't agree with them at all. And if you go to the very end of the tshuva, jump a couple of pages, we don't have time to go through the entire tshuva, I'm giving you, you know, basically the main crux of it. He says, "Bahasa likna uvahana chisna deleka lamechash the pisulei chisun madas atiyopim." You don't have to worry about pisulei chitun mutarm lava b'kai yisod lo shum gear apilu luchumva. And therefore, it's mutter for them to enter into the covenant of Israel without any gear whatsoever, whatsoever apilu luchumva. So I don't know what to do with all this, but I will tell you that Rav Yitzchak Yosef is writing and representing his father's view for contemporary audiences here in Tufshin Pei Beis, and he's very clear, I'm not letting you get away without a Giyur L'Chumah. And I'm attributing that to my father. So very, very, I'm just saying, it's a very, very intriguing, interesting thing. Now, I think some of it may come from a realization that many have as they speak more to the authorities within the Ethiopian community. I used to go, I mean, I still go to this conference of Dayanim every single year in Eretz Yisrael. Hopefully we'll be able to convene. It's supposed to take place the beginning of February. Yetz Hashem, we'll see what happens if they open up the borders again, you know, but by then. Every single year at this conference, they would have the head of the Ethiopian Jewish community. There was a Rabbi Yosef Hadana. So Rav Amar, or Shlomo Moshe Amar, who was, of course, you know, also was the former Sephardic Chief Rabbi of Israel, and is now the Sephardic Chief Rabbi of Jerusalem. So he wrote an article in Tehumen about his own view towards an Ethiopian Jewry, which, not surprisingly, is basically the same as Rav Avadya's view. And he throws in as well, like Rav Avadya does, that if you look at the way they perform, even the Kiddushin are not good Kiddushin, not only in terms of Eidim Psulim, he says, but there's no Maisa Kiddushin. There's no ring given by the husband to the wife. There's no Harayat Mekudeshis that the husband says to the wife. The husband and the wife don't actually say anything to each other the entire time. It's just whoever is the quote-unquote Kohen, minister, who performs the wedding, says, oh, everybody, we're gathered together today, and it's wonderful these two people are getting married. But they don't actually say anything themselves. They don't give anything to each other. So therefore he says there's absolutely nothing. There's no Maisa Kiddushin. So he says in addition to that, and he says that since they were always very, very meticulous about their Mesorah, so if they have no Maisa Kiddushin today, it means they never had a Maisa Kiddushin. So he says you don't have to worry about the fact that there's no Gittin because there was never any Kiddushin. It's not a question of what are Idim Psulim, or they Tinok Shin Nishpa, maybe they're not an Eid Pasul, or they Tzadik Ubaisos based, or they are Idim Psulim. He says it's not relevant because there's no ma'aseh kedushin altogether. But Rav Shlomo Amar, so it's very, very, it's very interesting. So he writes as well in terms of his own knowledge base of the Ethiopian Jewish communities, and he says a lot of it is based on his conversations with this Rav Yosef Hadana. So I would speak to Rav Yosef Hadana as well when I went to these conferences, because, you know, you sit at the table, you have lunch with people, whatever. So Rav Yosef Hadana explained to me that there are lots of different shades and lots of different stripes within the Ethiopian community. And some of them have better yichus, and some of them have worse yichus, and some of them it's questionable in terms of intermarriage, and some of them they were very, very careful in terms of intermarriage. It says in every single case, you have to investigate every single case on its own merits. And the merits of some are going to be better than the merits of the other. So I think that as the Rabbanim, this is just my own hypothesis, as the Rabbanim became more aware of the fact that, that there was a lot of complexity, even amongst the rabbinic experts within the Ethiopian community, regarding, you know, which, you know, how much you could really trust the legitimacy of any particular person who claims to, you know, have the status of an Ethiopian Jew throughout the generations. So there was more of an appreciation, I think, for the importance of just doing a Gio L'chumra to be on the safe side, to be on the safe side. Now, what's interesting is that Rav Moshe, if you look, has two tshuvas about the Ethiopian Jews, and I see we're at the 59-minute mark, so I'll go a couple of minutes just to touch a little bit upon everything. I'm always like a little bit overly ambitious. I apologize for that. So Rav Moshe in the wrote about it towards the end of his life. He wrote one shuv in Tafshin Mem Dalet to Rav Mordechai Tendler, his grandson, and one shuv in Tafshin Mem Hei to his grandson of Dr. Yaakov Tendler, both of whom I know very well, Baruch Hashem. And the tshuva to Rav Yaakov Tendler, which was the second tshuva, was published before the tshuva to Rav Mordechai, which was the first tshuva. I don't know exactly why that was, but somehow that was just the order of publication. So he said that he felt that it was very, very important for them to undergo a Gio L'chumra. And if you take a look, this is a look at source Tez Zayin, which was really the first tshuva. He says, Kashu l'smoch azeh, I don't want to rely upon the Radbaz alone. Why don't I want to rely upon the Radbaz alone? Shalom barim and Radbaz yada heitim masiyas adosam. Because suddenly the anthropologists are becoming much more, you know, prominent, you know, as the tshuvas go on. He said, I don't know if the Radbaz really knew so well what he was looking at. I don't know if he really knew the sociology there. Like the Radbaz, you know, he thought they were from Shevet Dan, but I'm not so sure. Gamlo barim adz manin ulishtanim etzavim. And also, when did the Radbaz live? Come on! Remember when we spoke about the Anusim? You know, I mean, lots of things can happen over like 500 years. So, you know, the Rabbis was talking in the 16th century. Where are we now? The 21st century when he wrote this late 20th century. I mean, lots of things could have happened. There could have been a lot of assimilation. There could have been a lot of intermarriage. There could have been a lot of bogus gayers that, you know, took place during the last 500 years. So therefore he says, now Dina, enam bisum mamzeres, but he says that despite the fact that I would require a gear of the chumra, I'm not worried about mamzeres. Why am I not worried about mamzeres? I'm not worried about mamzeres because of all of the sfeikos that were mentioned by the Radbaz. And the other interesting thing that he says in the next tshuva that he wrote to his son Yaakov Tendler, which he speaks about, oh, and the other, I shouldn't leave out, that he says, he's really upset about the fact that when they do come to Eretz Yisrael, they're not embraced with open arms, and he says, I have a feeling it's because of their skin color. I just have a sneaky feeling that it has to do with their skin color. And that's what he says. He doesn't pull any punches. And I remember being in Eretz Yisrael, like in the mid-80s, because that's when I spent my year in Eretz Yisrael, when they were coming in. That's when, you know, all the Ethiopians were coming in. And the question was, you know, about them going through the gear and indoctrinating them with Torah and mitzvos and making sure that, you know, they would be brought into the fold. And I remember overhearing at least one conversation where somebody said, but, you know, they're, you know, kind of, maybe what's going to happen? Can I marry them? I mean, you know, they're, you know. Rav Moshe is saying there's no place for that type of prejudice within the Jewish people. There's no such thing. He says, the Pasha Chiesh the Kavam. Lorak Misar Chainim Grui Misha Yehudim, and no worse than any of the Jews. Ain Ladina Chiluk Mashem Shechorim. It makes no difference what your skin color is. And the more so, says Rav Moshe, given the fact that we are requiring geirus, so that means that there's a good chance that they have the status of geirus. And you know what? There's a mitzvah of Avtem and Segeir. So therefore, you have to, you know, shower them with greater love and greater affection. After I spent my year in Eretz Yisrael, not that I have time for anecdotes, I actually spent some time the following summer. I was in Afula Elite, and I helped to run a school program in the morning and a summer camp in the afternoon and evening for the Ethiopian immigrants. I did that with a bunch of, you know, other yeshiva people who were learning for during the year. And I have to say, it was a very rewarding experience. And I was like, we're mamish, like, teaching these people. Yeah, I just didn't have, remember, there were certain girls who were like 13 years old and they were covering their hair because they were married already. It was fascinating, really a fascinating time to be in Eretz Yisrael. And there was all this controversy about whether there was a requirement for geiros or not. But anyway, if you look at Rav Schechter has an article on the Jewishness of the Ethiopian Jewry, and he brings the argument, which is sort of like, I suppose, the obvious argument that hasn't been stated, and that this is sort of like a little bit of a summary of the next few pages regarding the B'nai Israel, where you also have these concerns: are they really Jewish? And if they're Jewish, are they legitimate? Do we have to worry about mamzeris that may have crept, you know, into their midst? Where the Tzitz Eliezer says, if you're going to say they're definitely Jewish, so then you have a real problem on your hands. And the Chuvas von Hagas from Moshe Sternberg says the same thing, because then you're not going to be able to rely upon the suffix that maybe they're not Jewish, and that's why they're legitimate. Because if you say they may not be Jewish, and this is, you know, part of the beauty of a Moshe's Chuva, you have a sfeika with respect to their mamzeris. Suffix that there's mamzeris, that maybe somebody, you know, in their heritage got married properly but didn't have a proper get and then remarried and had children. But suffix that it doesn't really matter because they weren't Jewish to begin with. So you have this fake, so then that solves all problems. So that's why, assuming that, you know, you can be mako when it comes to mamzeris with fake, that we generally assume you can be. And that Rav Schechter presents that as basically, you know, the winning argument in terms of why you don't have to worry about the legitimacy of the Ethiopians, but why it's also very important to make sure that you always perform a conversion. And the same thing with respect to the B'nai Israel. Even though the official position of many of those who were involved in the Rabbanut was that the B'nai Israel are 100% legit, and that they do and that they're 100% Jewish, and that they have a very strong tradition that they were 100% Jewish, but it seems that those traditions are even less solid, arguably, than the traditions, you know, with respect to the Ethiopian Jews, because they at least have a Radvaz. But in Israel, the sources are not, you know, nearly as sound. So there, you know, you can understand much more why it would be appropriate to have a guest. We had somebody who was serving as a mashgiach for us in India, because we have plans in India, who was from the B'nai Israel. We found this out. We didn't know they were from the B'nai Israel. So they came to me. You know, so Abeza, what are we going to do? They're from the B'nai Israel. So, you know, your Rashkiah presumably has to be Jewish. So can we assume that the person is Jewish? So, you know, I said, well, you look in Ramosha, after he writes about the Ethiopian Jews. So Ramosha says, this is at the end of the Tshuva in Chelek Hay, where he says, on the top of page 9, he says that open kali yeshahatzer geirus lechumah lehabnei Yisrael meIndia. The B'nai Yisrael you require geirus lechumah v'chav shemiskayim mutam levo bikabel kibli pikbok shalmaz b'zeirus ke'en she'ista b'shuas v'advaz. But once you've done the gear, so then you can rely on all the sfeikas that the advaz mentioned, as well as I mentioned, you know, the sfeika, which you'll see in the tshuva of the Sternbuch if you get around to reading that as well. We see that there are, you know, different views, that, you know, Moshe requires the Gil, the Chumrah, the Piske Din Eretz Yisrael, quotes the various views, some didn't, and so forth. So I said, I don't want to get involved with this, because the other thing Moshe writes in his Chuvah is, I don't want to paskin for Eretz Yisrael. From the B'nai Israel, he says, ultimately, you know, I'm giving you my opinion, but, you know, the Rabbanu should decide what they want to do. And this person was living with his wife in Eretz Yisrael, so I said, I don't want to paskin Eretz Yisrael. This is a complicated situation with the B'nai Israel, but you know what I'll do? If the Rabbanut, you know, some legitimate branch of the Rabbanut, a Rabbanut Bezdin, a bona fide Rabbanut Bezdin, writes me a letter saying that they have researched and verified the status of this individual, and they have determined that this person is Jewish, we'll use the person as a mashgiach. So because we're talking about, should we require the person to go to a mikvah? So I'm not going into that. I said, I rely upon the Rabbanut. So the person got a letter from the Rabbanut saying that they're legitimately, you know, Jewish. So, you know, at the end of the day, we were able to rely upon that. And some say you just, you know, check several generations up to make sure that there was no intermarriage or no reisa or no, you know, marriage with krovim, with close relatives for several generations, and then you can rely upon that. But, you know, there are different views that, you know, ultimately you have to know your place when it comes to resolving these issues. So it's not a simple thing, you know, dealing with questions of yichus, but I hope I've given you, you know, a little bit of a taste, a little bit of a flavor.
In this Lechumrah game, yeah. May you require a learning period or no?
Yes. It has to be done legitimately. Yeah. And some of the poskim get very upset because they say that with some of them you didn't have a legitimate process, and it really does have to be like a real, you know, a real serious process in order for it to count. Yeah, absolutely.
Be a real football. There's one good blessing for you.
The Falashim Mora. The Falashim Mora is a much more complicated situation because they really converted out. They converted out into not observing Judaism altogether, and there's much less of a record of Judaism with respect to this group. And Rav Amar writes at the end of his Chukas, a lot of the later shipments of, or whatever it's called, the airlifts, yeah, of the Ethiopians that took place during Rav Amar's tenure, uh-huh, as the part of chief rabbi. And I know some of the people, the tape is off, right? I mean, I'm friendly with Joe Feit, you know, is, you know, a major mover and shaker, you know, and all of this and so forth.